Hi, everyone. This is Carrie. This podcast is going to start our discussion on cancer. It follows the PowerPoint Cancer Overview. The current textbook we're using is Lewis, and so there's a chapter on cancer in there as well if you'd like to follow along. So cancer in and of itself is a neoplastic disorder that can involve all body organs with manifestations that vary according to the body system affected and the type of tumor cells that are there. It's actually a group of more than 200 diseases. It's not one specific disease. Every cancer cell within a person's body functions a little bit different for that person. And so therefore, it's not one specific thing that we can treat with one medication. As we go through the discussion, you'll see that it's going to take various forms of medication and treatments to overcome cancer cells that develop in our body. The cells that turn into cancer actually lose their normal growth controlling mechanism, and therefore they grow out of control and they're unregulated, and so therefore they can take over all parts of the cell. And we'll go into that process again, like I said, mentioned a little later. It occurs in all ethnic groups and all ages, and as you can see as you look through the next slide, in 2010, there's an estimated U.S. cancer deaths for men and for women. For men, it was lung and bronchus cancer was the majority of the cancer, and that fell right there with women as well, with 26% with lung and bronchus. So you can just kind of browse through that slide and just kind of see what the main cancers are that we're dealing with here in the United States. If you look to the next slide, the lifetime probability of developing cancer, and the first slide shows men, and the second slide actually shows women. And if you look at that site or that slide for the men, for development in all sites, it's 1 in 2. So 50% of all guys at some point in their life, according to the statistics we now see, are going to develop some form of cancer. Whereas in women, that drops down to 1 in 3. So maybe a little healthier. I'm not sure. Genetic makeup are different. You know, the things that make us hormonal might defend us from some cancer as well. So some good with the bad as we look through that. Cancer incidence and prevalence, the next slide, slide 6. Most frequently, what I want you to think of when you see that slide is African Americans are more likely to develop and die from cancer than any other race in the United States. And so even with Caucasians, we see it more in African Americans. And so that's basically what you can see and pull off that slide, is there does seem to be an ethnicity that factor that can play in. Risk factors for the development of cancer. The number one thing to think about is age. As we all grow older, our body is exposed to more and more carcinogens throughout the environment and illness, and therefore increases our risk for the development. Gender, we kind of covered that as seen in the previous slide, so I'm not going to talk about that again. Geographic location, I took out the next slide, so there's really nothing there on the next slide to look at. But the thoughts behind that is, depending on where you're at, you're going to see different forms of cancer being more prevalent. Here in the Midwest, with the herbicides and pesticides that we put on the ground that can leak into the groundwater, we have more cancer from those types of carcinogens, whereas on the coast, it can be more from various types of fish that are eaten. It can be from air pollution, from the highly populated cities. So those types of things all play into the genetic development within the different areas. Genetics also is a big one that's been in the news a lot lately. Some factors that fall into that include specific genes and chromosomal changes that follow within certain genetic patterns. Some women have had, because they carry a certain cancer or gene for breast cancer, they've actually had their breasts removed as a prophylactic cure for the possibility that they could actually come down with cancer. So genetics, we're learning more and more with technology how the role that genetics actually play in the development of cancer. Immune disturbances can actually happen. Cancer will develop higher in people who are actually immunosuppressed, such as those with AIDS or organ transplant recipients who are taking immunosuppressive medications. So if for any reason they can't fight off infection appropriately, they're also not fighting off any abnormal cells that could turn into cancer, so their cancer risk is increased. chemical agents, or occupational exposure. Depending on where people work, that can actually affect people quite a bit. Industrial chemicals, drugs, tobacco can fall under different chemical carcinogens. There's some physical carcinogens that actually can fall under that too for occupational exposure. If they work in radiology, diagnostic and x-rays are people who take x-rays actually are exposed to ionizing radiation. If they work in the sun a lot, people, your carpenters and your people who work on the beaches can have increased risk because of that. Viral carcinogens also can cause cancer. A virus can. There's such a thing known as an oncovirus, the Epstein-Barr virus, hepatitis B virus, and human papillomavirus, the HPV with the HPV vaccine. Hopefully you guys have heard about that. That all can actually, HPV can lead to cervical cancer. And so one of the things that we're now learning that different viruses can make us more susceptible. With the race, we talked about that with African Americans have an increased risk. Tobacco and alcohol are always going to fall into there, as well as recreational drugs. Sun exposure, we talked about that with the environment. Diet as well, believe it or not. Obesity and dietary factors, including preservatives, contaminants, additives, and nitrates. We're learning more and more about the preservatives in our food, that they actually can be bad for us in our body, especially over a long period of time. Some other things that have fallen into that can be poverty and stress can increase our metabolism and alter our cellular function within our body, and therefore over a long period of time can actually weaken our bodily responses and increase our risk for the development of cancer. If we look at the next slide, American Cancer Society has different recommendations for screening and things to look for. There are 7 warning signs. It's going to be very important for you to know these. Those are found on page, in the current text, it's 269. So let's talk about those quickly. There are 7 warning signs of cancer. They actually spell out the word caution, or the acronym. C stands for a change in bowel or bladder habits. A, a sore that does not heal. U, unusual bleeding or just discharge from any body orifice. T, thickening or a lump in the breast or elsewhere. I, indigestion or difficulty in swallowing. O, obvious change in a wart or mole. And N, a nagging cough or hoarseness. I know you're probably going to see those on the test, so it's going to be important to recognize those. Screening, therefore, is part of what the American Cancer Society is recommending. We want to prevent and screen regularly. So if a cancer starts, we can actually be on top of it and get it while it's still small, or possibly before it's even metastasized within the body. And therefore, we can help prevent the spread of it. There's screening for breast cancer, colon and rectal cancer, uterine, as well as prostate cancers. So if you are, it's important to get those regular screenings if it is the time. Generally, they don't start those unless you have a genetic predisposition until generally about the age between 40 and 50 years of age. Obviously, avoid known carcinogens. If you smoke, that is just a known carcinogen in that tobacco. Removal of at-risk tissues, again, possibly removing any tissue or lymph area that is in a possible area where there is cancer or a benign area around cancer cells. So the cancer, they're removing any possibility that there could be anything there. There's also such a thing on this slide, you'll see chemoprotection. That is a therapeutic technique in which bone marrow cells are removed from an individual with cancer and are genetically modified to withstand higher doses of chemo before being returned to the donor. And so if we know someone is going to have high doses of chemo, in order to avoid some of the severe side effects of the medications they're going to take, they will do some chemoprotection, what they call, prior to the treatment. And we'll talk about chemotherapy more later. So let's talk a little bit about cancer itself and what cancer is. Cancer can be cells actually that are, uncontrolled growth of cells that actually can spread throughout the body. They can actually be solid tumors. usually associated with an organ from which they develop, such as a breast or lung cancer, or there can be such a thing as hematologic cancers, that and that hematologic should trigger us to think of blood, where it originates in the blood cell-forming tissues, and that's our leukemias, our lymphomas, multiple myelomas, and we've talked about leukemia, so that hopefully makes a little bit of sense to us. It is then further defined. We have benign. If we're looking back at our slide now, we have benign neoplasms. These are slow-growing and non-malignant, so it's important to think, when you think about benign, that's a term that means it's, we don't have to worry about it spreading to other areas of the body. It's localized and it's encapsulated. So generally, when there's a benign tumor, they'll go in and they'll just remove that whole tumor to get rid of those cancerous cells. Malignant neoplasms, on the other hand, are aggressive growths that invade and destroy surrounding tissues. So they're part of a solid tumor, but they're not encapsulated. So they start to project fingers and growths that extend to the tissues that surround that area. Generally, malignant neoplasms can be fatal if not treated aggressively, because they generally spread quite rapidly. Metastasis is another term that you're going to hear a lot with cancer, and that means malignant cells that actually move through the body or the lymph system. So if someone has had, say, lung cancer and they've been being treated, then all of a sudden cancer cells appear on their liver, or they do a biopsy and find that there's some cancer cells in the liver. The primary site would still be the lungs, but it has metastasized then as well to the liver. And cancers can metastasize really anywhere in the body. It's also the invasion of other tissue or organs to form a secondary tumor, and that's what I explained. So let's talk just a few minutes here again about how the cancer actually develops. So we'll look here at our next slide. This is a picture. There's also one in your textbook that talks about the same thing. It demonstrates the life cycle of the cell and the cell's actually metabolic activity. There are two major dysfunctions present in the process of cancer, and they are the defective cellular proliferation or growth and the defective cellular differentiation. And I'm going to talk about a little bit about what each of that means. And the cancers form or can take control at different parts of the cell cycle, and that's why that's important. Normally, most tissue of the human adult contains populations of predetermined, undifferentiated cells known as stem cells. Predetermined means that the stem cells of a particular tissue will ultimately differentiate and become mature, functioning cells of that tissue and only that tissue. Cell proliferation originates in the stem cell and begins when the stem cell enters the cell cycle that you see on the slide. The time from when a cell enters a cell cycle to when the cell divides into two identical cells is called the generation time of the cell. Normal cells respect the boundaries and territories of the cells surrounding them. They're not going to invade a territory that is not their own. Neighboring cells are thought to inhibit cellular growth through the physical contact of the surrounding cells. Cancer cells grow in tissue culture, and they are characterized by loss of contact inhibition. These cells have no regard for cellular boundaries and will grow on top of one another and also on top or between normal cells. This rate of normal cellular proliferation from the time of cellular birth to the time of cellular death, which differs in each body tissue. In some tissues, such as bone marrow, hair follicles, and epithelial lining of the GI tract, the rate of cellular proliferation is rapid. In other tissues, such as the myocardium and cartilage, cellular proliferation does not occur or is very slow. Cancer cells themselves usually proliferate at the same rate as the normal tissue cells from where they arise. However, some cancer cells respond differently than normal cells to the intracellular signals that regulate the state of the dynamic equilibrium. So cancer cells can divide indiscriminately and haphazardly, so they can do their own thing. Sometimes they produce more than two cells at the time of mitosis. So even though cancer cells generally grow at the same rate of the cells of the organ they're invading, they can have mutations, they can have alterations within that cell cycle of when that cell is developing, and they can actually produce at a more rapid rate as well. And so when you're looking at this, that part of it, it's important just to know that throughout any part, you don't have to memorize specific parts of that cell cycle. It can happen at any point throughout that generation cycle, depending on the type of cancer that it is. I want to talk to again now just a little bit about the cell defect and cellular differentiation. Cellular differentiation is normally an orderly process that progresses from a state of immaturity to a state of maturity of the cell. Because all body cells are derived from a fertilized ova, all cells have the potential to form all body functions. As cells differentiate, this potential is repressed, and the mature cell is capable of performing only specific functions. With cellular differentiation, there is a stable and orderly phasing out of cellular potential. So the cells learn to become the cell that they were made to be, kind of like when you go to college and you have a career, you take a path and you choose where you want to go. That kind of happens with the cells as well. There are some different types of genes that can be affected that I want to talk about because you may recognize them. I don't have them on the slides and I'm not testing on them, but you may hear these terms, so I just want you to be a little bit familiar with them. So two types of normal genes that can be affected by this mutation are called proto-oncogenes, and they're normal cellular genes that are important regulators of normal cellular processes. Proto-oncogenes promote growth, whereas tumor suppressor genes, such as the gene from the tumor protein of P53, and you'll see many, many different names of suppressor cells and cancer cells throughout the text. Again, I'm not going to ask you to memorize any of those. But these mutations can alter the expression of the proto-oncogenes, and this can activate them to function as what we call as an oncogene, O-N-C-O-G-E-N-E, and these are tumor-inducing genes. The protogene has been described as the genetic lock that keeps the cell in its mature functioning state. When this lock is unlocked, as may occur through exposure to different carcinogens, the different things that can cause cancer, or oncogenic viruses, genetic alterations and mutations can occur. These oncogenes interfere with normal cellular expression under some conditions, and that causes the cell then to become malignant. So then let's look at some of the characteristics of malignant cells, and that's the next slide. When a cell becomes malignant, generally there's rapid cell division and replication that we just kind of went through. There's no contact inhibition, like we just had mentioned, loss of differentiation, ability to migrate, and these cells, they don't just stay in one area like the rest of our cells do. If it's a cell that belongs in the lung, it's matured in that area, it knows it's supposed to stay. These cancer genes or oncogenes and cancer cells actually have no turf wars or boundaries within the body. They're going to go wherever they want, and therefore they migrate and move in the blood and in our lymph fluid. There's also alteration in cell structure. They change the cell and take over the cell and cause it to be basically a non-functioning cell within the body. Also, some of these cancer cells have self-survival. They do not need blood flow or other bodily food sources to survive. They can function and basically on their own. They're a self-serve type of a cell, which makes them that much harder to kill as well. This next slide talks through the process of cancer development, and that's kind of what we've been talking about a little bit. This picture is also found in your textbook. But as we can see, we have the initiation. We have a virus, hormones, radiation, chemicals, genetic factors, or almost anything else that affects our target cell. It goes in and it alters the cell in its development at some point in that process. We there have an altered cell. Dysfunction in the differentiation and proliferation. It then turns into what we call a cancer cell. From there, the cancer cell continues to grow and spread. And when there's enough of those cancer cells that grow and spread in an area, a tumor generally or a lump develops. If there are no tumor or lumps, especially in the blood, you're not going to necessarily feel that. People are going to have more of the physical signs of weakness, fatigue, malaise that are going to bring them to the doctor, and they'll have to do some blood work to figure it out. So once the cancer cells start to develop, they start to grow and spread throughout the body. The next slide talks about some diagnostic tests and methods of assessment. And this slide is going to be important for you to understand. So I want to spend a little bit of time talking about each of these different diagnostic tests and things that I want you to know here. There's grading. The textbook goes through the grading as well. There's grade 1 through 5. Grade 1 basically means it's a low grade, whereas grade 5, it's the highest grade, meaning it's quite advanced, and therefore it's very hard to determine the cells of origin or where the cancer actually started, because it's probably spread throughout most of the body. If it's a grade 5, their prognosis is probably pretty poor. Staging also takes effect here, and the tumor staging, the classification system, there's a table in your textbook that talks about that. Staging, we like to think of the T, N, and M. Actually, staging has different, besides the T, N, and M, it also has a various stage. You can have stage 0 to stage 4. Stage 0 means cancer in situ, and basically that it has its own designation in the system, and therefore it has not invaded anything. It is encapsulated, and it's easily corrected and fixed, basically. Whereas stage 4 is metastasis, and it's going through the different systems. So they're going to give them a clinical staging of either 0 to 4. Then they're going to also rank them on the TNM classification system. And T stands for tumor size, N, the lymph node involvement, and M for metastasis. And I want you to just take a quick peek at the textbook a little bit and look at that. T with a little 0 means no evidence of a primary tumor. T with an IS means the carcinoma in situ, so it's an encapsulated, though there's no metastasis to that area. And then you can have the tumor 1 through 4, and that was the staging that we talked about before, because they can actually list what it is. And then they can have the TX, the tumor cannot be measured or found. For the N, the lymph nodes, and N0, obviously the 0 is always a good thing. No evidence of disease in lymph nodes. Then you can have an N1 through 4, just like that staging. It'll stage it to the degree that it is. And then the NX as well. And so each one kind of follows that same guideline. And I know there is a question on the test that talks about the staging of a tumor, and I'll give you an example. It'll give you a rating of a T, N, and an M. And so you just need to be able to kind of interpret that for the patient with what that would mean. So make sure you look through that. There are also different tumor markers that we can look at, and I want to spend a little bit of time here talking about the body's natural defense systems, because that's what we're going to be looking at when we're looking at these different tumor markers. Our body actually has our immune system will naturally try to fight off various cells that come in and that start to mutate. Obviously, we're not real successful with defeating cancer cells within the body, but we do try. And I want you to be a little bit familiar with what some of those cells are. So our immune system actually has the potential to distinguish cells that from ourselves to abnormal cells. For example, cells of transplanted organs can be recognized by the immune system as non-self and therefore elicit an immune response. This response can ultimately result in rejection of that organ. Similarly, cancer cells can be perceived as non-self and elicit an immune response, resulting in their rejection and destruction. However, unlike transplanted cells, cancer cells arise from normal human cells, and although they are mutated and therefore different, the immune response is mounted against cancer cells. It may be inadequate to effectively kill them. Cancer cells display altered cell surface antigens as a result of malignant transformation, so they actually look different on the outside with the antigens that they carry. These antigens that the cancer cells carry are known as tumor-associated antigens, or TAAs. It is believed that one of the functions of the immune system is to respond to these TAAs. The response of the immune system to antigens of the malignant cells is termed as immunologic surveillance. So this In this process, lymphocytes continually check cell surface antigens and detect and destroy cells with abnormal or altered antigenic determinants. It has been proposed that malignant transformation occurs continually and that the malignant cells are destroyed by our immune response. Under most circumstances, immune surveillance will prevent these transformed cells from developing into clinically detectable tumors. So the thought with this is that our body's continually having these cells, cancer cells per se, developed in our body, but those of us with strong immune systems are strong enough that our body is able to fight them off themselves. Immune response to these malignant cells involve our cytotoxic T cells, our natural killer cells, our macrophages, and our B lymphocytes. Hopefully this all sounds familiar to you a little bit, but I'm just going to kind of talk about this briefly. Our cytotoxic T cells play a dominant role in resisting tumor growth. These cells are capable of killing tumor cells. T cells are also important in the production of cytokines, our interleukin-2 and Y-interferon, and we'll talk about interleukin-2 a little bit later as a form of treatment and helping to actually boost our immune system to fight cancer. It's an alternative treatment that we're actually using more and more of. And these stimulate our T cells, our natural killer cells, B cells, and macrophages, so it helps them actually give them a little more boost so they can fight a little harder. Our natural killer cells are able to directly lyse tumor cells spontaneously without any prior sensitization. These cells are stimulated by the Y interferon and our interleukin-2, which are released from the T cells, resulting in increased cytotoxic activity. So these cells, the natural killer cells, really do a great job. When we talk about our tumor markers, actually, we have oncofetal antigens and tumor markers. These oncofetal antigens are a type of a tumor antigen that we just talked about. They are found on both surfaces, the surface and the inside of cancer cells, as well as fetal cells. These antigens are an expression of the shift of cancer cells to a more immature metabolic pathway, an expression usually associated with embryonic or fetal period of life. So the reappearance of fetal antigens in malignant disease is not well understood, but it is believed to occur as a result of the cell remaining in its embryonic capability to differentiate into the many different types of cells throughout the body. An example of these oncofetal antigens are the CEA and AFP, which is the alpha fetal protein. CEA is found on the surface of cancer cells derived from the GI tract and from normal cells of the fetal liver, the gut, and the pancreas. Normally, it disappears during the last 3 months of the fetal life. They actually, if it's not there, then they actually can grow into tumors and cancer. These oncofetal antigens can be used as tumor markers that can be clinically useful to monitor the effect of therapy and indicate tumor recurrence. For example, the persistence of elevated preoperative CEA titers after surgery indicate that the tumor is not completely removed. A rise in CEA levels after chemotherapy or radiation may indicate recurrence or spread of the cancer. So they're going to look at that, where AFP is actually produced by malignant liver cells as well as fetal liver cells. So AFP has diagnostic value in primary cancer of the liver, but it also is also produced when metastatic liver growth occurs. So the detection of AFP is a value in tumor detection and determination of tumor progression, especially within the liver. Other tumor markers that you will see include various hormones and isoenzymes. There's also tissue-specific markers such as PSA, which is a prostate-specific antigen. So with the technology we have today, there are so many different things that we can now pinpoint the true cause or what is feeding that cancer or the different chemical systems within our body that is helping to regulate that. We can monitor those levels and see how we are actually controlling our cancer, and that's actually how we're kind of getting on top of and increasing our survival rate with these cancers. So it's kind of cool how that's happening. Biopsy, I want to talk about the next little tab there. Biopsy and cytology. It's used to help to decide treatment options. A biopsy actually is a definitive means of diagnosing cancer, and it provides histologic proof of malignancy. So we're actually going to go in and remove part of the tumor cells themselves and take a look at them. There's different types of biopsies. There's needle aspiration, where they actually just go in with a needle and a syringe and just withdraw some of the cancer cells. There's actually incisional, where they take a part of the tissue for larger masses. They'll go in and actually with us in surgery and take some out. Excisional is complete remover of the entire lesion. Or they also have a type that's called staging, where they do multiple needle or incisional biopsies in tissue where metastasis is suspected or likely. So that means they're going to just, if they think it has spread to an area, they're going to take multiple samples to see how far it has spread or to the extent it has spread through an organ. With biopsy, because it is an invasive procedure, we always have to remember that we're going to need a consent for that. Cytology just means they're sending the cells to be tested. There are different labs that we can look at that can tell us what's going on. We have ALK-FOS, we have calcium. Again, those and AFP are all part of the liver. Also, AFP has also been found to be effective in helping to diagnose testicular cancer. AST, ALT, bilirubin bleeding studies. Why are we concerned with all of those labs is just a question that I hopefully you're thinking through your mind. Remember, our liver is our filter for our body. And so anytime there's a cancer, our liver is highly susceptible because all of our blood, everything that we have, if it's not in our GI tract, all the blood that's coming in contact with those cancer cells is getting filtered through the liver. So generally, if there's any rise in our liver labs, that we're going to see a possible increased risk of cancer in that area. Diagnostic studies include x-rays, they can do MRI, CT scans, nuclear imaging studies, PET scans. There are many different types of scans that are used to detect cancers. So I'm going to stop this first podcast here. There's a lot of information in this first 13 slides. When I come back, start the next podcast, we're going to start with slide 14, and we're going to actually look at some different slides and pictures of carcinomas.